Cross on over to Lebanon. Saeed Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, is giving a speech. Let's take a listen to what he's saying.
Son Ja'far, son of Muhammad al-Sadiq, may peace be upon them. And on this occasion, or during this speech, I would like to speak. As you know, I do have my list of subjects. I want to speak about the occasion, then about the general situation, then I would touch on the Israeli elections, and I would also like to speak, or I will speak, about the situation in Lebanon. If you want to evaluate any figure or judge it, whether positively or negatively, or if we want to specify or pinpoint the level of positiveness or negativeness, there are different levels which we could refer to. However, first and foremost, most important of all, we have two levels. First of all, we have what this figure possesses, what it makes this figure unique on the level of mind and soul, oneself, the manners, the character, what we call the capabilities and the uniqueness of a specific individual, whether they be good traits or bad traits, whether they be, of course, good features or bad. Second of all is what this figure does, the action it takes, the effect of this person's actions, the achievements made by this figure, what this figure brought about for the people, what this figure left for the people, whether they be achievements or difficulties or catastrophes. With respect to the first perspective, we find that our great prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, we find that Prophet Muhammad has a lot, whether it be spiritually or psychologically or in his mind. This led him to the highest level. In God's book, there is a reference to this great prophet, and also what was said by the previous prophets who came before Prophet Muhammad, and all those who also lived at the same time of the prophet, whether they were believers, people who believed in him as family members or as companions, or those who were his enemies or his rivals, all of them, irrespective, they recognized that the Prophet, may peace be upon him, was complete, had completeness. And when this great Prophet is described by Allah, when Allah describes him of having great character, when he speaks about the mercy, about the character, about the culture, about his humanitarian, as about his humane behavior, humanitarian behavior, all of this which completes him, everybody recognized this, pledging, living up to the pledges, the honesty. And so we find that his enemies, the enemies of the Prophet, never found anything in him which was incomplete in his personality. They never found one gap, one hole. They never found one negative aspect whereby they could penetrate. Some people might consider, for example, that there might be some reservations, that he couldn't read, that he was illiterate. But this is one of his strengths. It is not one of his weaknesses. This shows his connection to God. This shows that he has education, a holy education. So this personality of the Prophet of God, may peace be upon him, and until today, everybody bears witness to this great personality. Let's leave the insults aside. I'll go back to it. However, the thinkers, the Muslims, the Christians, the intellectuals, the philosophers, the high-ranking intellectuals in the world, those who evaluate historic figures in a fair and in a just way, in an educational, objective manner, I don't think that there is anyone of those people who found such a person. I don't think we've ever seen any unanimity regarding the character, the personality of the Prophet. If we speak about the second perspective now, on the second level, yes, what was left behind, what was achieved, what the Prophet brought about, the ideological transformations, the social, political transformations, and also the transformations in general, the transformations in general as a civilization, the transformations we witnessed in the civilizations, the Ummah, which he created and which he launched in history, which continues until today, and based upon humanitarian and foundations of faith. One of the most important points which we must remind you of today, my brothers and sisters, one of the most important points which we must remind you of is that the Prophet, may peace be upon him, the Prophet of Islam, may peace be upon him, he brought humanity back at that time, and ever since then until now he brought them back to the appropriate stance. He further enhanced the humanity in general, in the society and in the community of the Arabian Peninsula and throughout the world at that time, whether it be the world which was controlled by the Roman Empire or the Persian Empire. People were, of course, controlled. The world was controlled by segregation, by discrimination between male and female, for example, and the female suffering was not only in the Arab Peninsula but throughout the world. Or we had also discrimination based upon color, black, white, brown, based upon race, Arabs, Persians, etc., based upon tribal affiliation, Quraysh and others, family ties. However, this Prophet came, this humanitarian, humane, great Prophet came and told all the people that you are all from Adam, from Prophet Adam, and Adam is from the soil, from the land. All people are humans. He came in order to tell them what God said, to tell them God's words, when God said that we created you as men and women. He was speaking to the community and to the society which used to marginalize and harm women ever since they were young children. He said that we created you men and women and made you people and tribes to get to know one another. So, male and female, they are at one level from a humane perspective. The same goes for Arabs, Persians, black, white, red, yellow, all the same. The master and the slave, because back then we had the era of slaves, but they were all on one level. How can such a society and community put up with such a rhetoric, the way they look down on the slaves? However, this religion and this prophet came with this humanitarian rhetoric which reflected or which was against and contradictory to all of the traditions and all of the cultures and all of the norms, all of the popular norms which existed at that time. The Prophet said, you have one value, you are all equal. However, what differentiates you is not the race or the color or the tribe or the race, as I said, or male or female. What differentiates us, what separates us, is the doing what is right, the sins. The best of you is he who is the best towards other people. He who is most loved by God is the one who serves his family. And even more, further, the Prophet, may peace be upon him, he stressed on the humanitarian perspective, even in behavior towards others. For example, with respect to orphans and the poor, those who are sick, those who have nobody to provide for them, those who are afraid, the displaced, the Prophet, may peace be upon him, he stressed on providing help and assistance for all of these people, not just providing financial help or financial assistance, not to provide only a safe shelter for them. The poor and the orphans and all those, etc., etc., all those people, they are not only a certain group which someone could benefit from their existence in this world to help them in order to get votes in the elections, or maybe to help them for the sake of being rewarded in the aftermath, for being given a seat in heaven being given a level in heaven. No, the prophet went further than this. He said that you must show humanitarian and humane feelings towards these people, feelings of love, feelings of brotherhood, feelings of respect, feelings of appreciation. And so the prophet, may peace be upon him, he sat down with the poor, and he met with them, and he used to feed them, and he spoke with them, and he showed moderation towards them. He lived their same way of life to show the humanitarian perspective. Some people might be rich and have a lot of money and distribute money to the poor as much as you might see, but if a poor person comes to shake his hand, maybe he turns back. To sit down and eat with the poor, that's not at his level. So there's a difference here. Even more, the prophet, may peace be upon him, he worked on changing the greedy people who only focused on their private interests or focused on the interests of their tribes, and tried to change this to for a human being to become a human who bears the concerns of the people, a person who feels pain when others feel pain, a person who feels happy when others are happy, a person who thinks of saving people, extending a hand of assistance to other people. And this shows also the great humanitarian perspective. Unfortunately, today we are witnessing a clear campaign to insult this great prophet and also to shed doubt in his humanitarian behavior. And this is one of the biggest challenges for our Islamic Ummah and for the Islamic clerics and for all the Muslims. Here I would like to speak about the general situation today. Now, when we witnessed insults like some caricatures, some cartoons, or some writings, or some films, which don't have an educational approach. We don't mind if anyone wants to discuss with us our ideas, our religion. We don't mind an objective discussion, an objective debate. We don't have any problem. Our Quran called for such a dialogue and called for such discussions, called for wisdom and a dialogue in the appropriate manner. However, insults and humiliation, this is something which nobody can accept for any sanctities, for any of any group. Of course, we must express our anger and our condemnation. However, what we must say today on the anniversary of the birth of this great prophet, may peace be upon him, is that one of our responsibilities is to work in a positive manner to get the world, to make the world get to know this prophet, his lifetime, what distinguishes him, his completeness, his religion, his call, his words. There are certain issues which are associated with the prophet which are unjust. Certain things are associated with the prophet, and these issues must be clarified. If anybody has some suspicions or skepticism, we must answer him. However, we must introduce this personality to the world, this historic, unique, great personality. We must introduce it to the world based upon the rule of don't hate something, it might be good for you. Generally, the Islamic movements, the Islamic clerics, the Muslim people, those who follow Islam from all different affiliations over decades and maybe for centuries, every one of us was trying to speak about the ummah of their specific sect, about their clerics, about their specific group, based upon the rule that there is no problem with respect to the prophet, there is unanimity, a common approach. So let's try and focus on introducing the figures whom we disagree about. However, in light of this challenge, irrespective of the fact that if what we're doing is right or wrong, there is a responsibility now on the shoulders of all the Muslims, on all the Muslim clerics, all those who follow Muslim sects. They must give a priority to introduce their prophet. They all agree that the prophet must be respected, must be worshipped, must be appreciated, and the prophet represents a unity of all of the Muslim sects. So we must introduce this prophet to the world. The world must get to know this prophet. So we must pursue efforts on the media, research. We must pursue different efforts in this regard to carry out this responsibility, and there must not be any neglect, because the other side is continuing with this confrontation or this battle, and the insults against our Prophet is not just something which is passing by. It's not only a personal step or a personal move which was taken. Certain sides which are studying what it wants from these insults are behind this. And as we said on previous occasions, the aim is to bring about sedition between Muslims and Christians, and also between Muslims and Muslims, and to drag the Muslims into reactions which might not be appropriate or might not be calculated. There are a lot of aims behind what is going on. One of the bigger or great challenges now in the general situation, when we look at our region, we find that there is an increase in the conflicts, the confrontations, the divisions. This exists today in many of the countries in the Arab and Islamic world. And this is present. It exists, whether it be on the sectarian level, if we speak about Muslims and Christians, as we are seeing in some of the countries of the Islamic world, for example, Nigeria, or we might see between Shia and Sunni, or labeling as Shia and Sunni sectarian confrontation. However, I'd like to look at the issues from a realistic perspective. In order not to exaggerate, I can say that the nature of the conflicts which we are witnessing today is more than being sectarian. Now there are Arab countries, maybe all of the people in the country might be Muslims with no Christians. They might all be from one sect. There might not be any Shia. And even inside the Sunnis, they might be from one specific school of thought. However, irrespective of this, we witness problems, we witnessed tension, because in all of the countries in the Arab and Muslim world, we have nationalist movements, we have Islamic movements, Sufis, Salafists, we have West, we have East, we have North, South, we have tribes, etc., etc. And we have the social matters, and we have different approaches, and so the chaos or the challenges which we are witnessing now in the region, it's not true that we can summarize them briefly to say that they are sectarian problems. No, this is not true. It's not true to consider that what is going on and summarize it as sectarian. It's more than that. So after saying this, we want to approach this reality as part. We in Lebanon, we are part of this region. We in Lebanon, we have our own problems, and we are part of the Arab and Muslim world, which is affected by what is going on in the Arab and Muslim world. We in Lebanon, we are affected, whether we like it or not. We are affected what goes on in the world as well. And Lebanon might be the country which is most affected by what goes on in its surroundings. In approaching these developments in the region, I would like to mention a few points. First of all, if we see tension, conflicts in a certain region, nobody should try and begin a confrontation or exaggerate. This existed. There were disagreements and conflicts throughout history. In the history of Muslims, we witnessed this before. And also between other than Muslims, between the Christians, also between the followers of other religions, throughout the history of the world, ever since God created Adam until today, we are witnessing what the angels said. Do you want to send someone who will shed the blood? As long as human beings are human beings and they have their wants, they have their needs, as long as they get bored, this happens. So the catastrophe, the biggest, most dangerous catastrophe, is not to know how to deal with these crises. For differences in a wise and responsible manner, then we can overcome, or we can at least belittle a lot of the difficulties which we might come against. This is first of all. Second of all, in our approach, even in the countries whereby there are different religions or different followers of different sects, the conflict in its fundamental nature is not always sectarian. Let's now refer to some numbers. I don't want to say that all of the conflicts and all of the wars which happened. I'm not speaking about ideological differences or religious disagreements. I'm speaking about conflicts and wars and confrontations where people attack each other and kill each other. Most of these wars which occurred, most of these conflicts which occurred were due to political reasons and had political goals are related to power, to control, to take control of the resources of the Ummah, and had nothing to do with religion or Shia or Sunnis. It had nothing to do, they had nothing to do with Christians or Muslims. A lot of the wars had this nature, not all of them, but most of them. Now here, I don't have the time to mention them, but I would like to give you two or three examples. For example, one of the biggest wars witnessed in the history of the Muslims was between Bani Umayyah and Banu Abbas. Bloodbaths, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands were killed during those days, during that transformation. What did Shia and Sunni and Islam and the Prophet of Islam, what did this have to do with? What did it have to do with that battle between Bani Umayyad and Abbas? It was a battle over who would rule. Then, between Amin and Ma'mun, the two Abbasis, a long war which continued for years. Also, tens of thousands were killed. What did Sunni and Shia have to do with it? So, in order for nobody to speak about Sunni and Shia all the time, Sunnis and Shia had nothing to do with it. Two brothers disagreed about who would be in power, and they launched a war against one another and destroyed the Ummah for the sake of power. During the Abbasi era, their rule continued for tens of years. The wars of the princes and also the other ministers, the invasions of cities. What did Shia and Sunni have to do with it? Hundreds of years. Yes, religion might have been taken advantage of, sects might have been taken advantage of. However, the true nature of the war was not for religious reasons. And let me now speak about more close history, more modern history, 500 years ago, Mamalik and the Ottomans. What did the Muslims have to do with it? On the contrary, the Ottomans came and the Mamaliks had a big national achievement which they made. The Ottomans came and they crushed them. So we can't say that this is a religious conflict or it's a sectarian conflict. No, it wasn't. Maybe some of the conflicts were, yes, but that they were the least number of conflicts. The majority were not of a religious nature. And just a few years ago, one of the most dangerous wars which we witnessed in our region, which laid the foundations for a political and security, a new political and security period, which brought the Americans and the fleets to the region, was the Saddam Hussein war against Kuwait. Was that a religious war? Was it between Shia and Sunni? No. What did Sunnis and Shias have to do with it? This was a war to control oil, to control territory. It was a war of power. Yes, as I said, sometimes some people might take advantage. For example, if the confrontation is between the Ottomans and the Mamalik, it's about power. However, if it's between the Ottomans and the Safawiyins, it becomes Shia and Sunni. No, it wasn't Shia and Sunni. It was a war for power. I don't want to take a stance against the Ottomans nor against the Safawis. I'm just giving you an example. Now, if the Ayyubis and the Mamaliks confront each other, then this is a war over power. However, if it's between the Ayyubis and the Fatimids, it's sectarian. However, in its depth, it's not about power. It's not about religion, sorry, it's about power. So a lot of the wars and a lot of the conflicts which we are witnessing today, I don't want to speak about history in order to refer to history. Now, a lot of the confrontations which we are witnessing today are political, have nothing to do with sex or religion or Christians or Muslims or Shiaism or converting to Sunni. For example, in the war which was waged by Saddam Hussein against the Islamic Republic for 8 years. Okay, he didn't speak about the religious aspect. He wasn't able to give it a religious aspect for a reason, for a clear reason, which is that a lot of the generals in the Iraqi army which was waging war on Iran, they were Shia. So how can he say that it was a sectarian religious war? He made it a Arab-Persian war. However, unfortunately, some of the Arab regimes today, some of them who don't care about Sunnis or about converting to Sunnis, who don't care about Palestine. And when we look at the statistics in the Arab world, most of the Arab world are Sunnis. We find that tens of billions of people are hungry, tens of billions are illiterate, tens of millions are unemployed, tens of millions, etc., etc. And we have regimes who have hundreds of billions of dollars piled on each other, and they don't do anything for the Sunnis. However, when you speak about a conflict with Iran, then it becomes Sunni and Shia, but it's not. No, it's not Sunni Shia. Even in the Iran-Iraqi war, Iran didn't deal with it as if it was a Sunni-Shia battle. It was the battle of Saddam Hussein and some of the regimes which stood in support of Saddam Hussein and provided him with hundreds of billions of dollars in that war. Now, based upon this analysis, what is required from us? First of all, we are called upon to keep any conflict or battle, whether it be Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen, Bahrain, Egypt, Tunisia, Libya. I'm not speaking only Sunni and Shia, Muslims, Christian, Shia, Sunnah, different affiliations, nationalists, Islamists. We must always focus and view these conflicts as political, not religious. We must abstain from the religious rhetoric, and we must abstain from religious sectarian incitement, because there are some who might take the beast out of the jar but not be able to put it back. And there are a lot of events which are testimonial to this. You might create a snake, bring about the snake with your religious rhetoric, but not be able to put it back, and it might bite you or kill you in the end. So any religious rhetoric or sectarian rhetoric today could destroy everything, could sabotage everything. And we must put all the problems in their perspective. If it's in a specific country, we put it in that country. If it's between two different sides, we leave it at that. We limit it to that. We must not generalize and open all of the issues and tie them with one another, because then it will be difficult to solve these problems. Number three, my dear brothers and sisters, to the Arab and the Islamic world, to the Christians and Muslims, to the Sunni and the Shia, to the nationalists and to the Islamists, unfortunately, now in different arenas, people are waging wars against one another. They want to eliminate one another. They are the sons of one revolution in more than one Arab country. So where does this lead us to? The only solution is for people to be patient, to open their chests, dialogue. It's better to be than being on a collision course. Even if we do collide, we must go back to dialogue, to look, search for a settlement, to search for a way to address the situation, search for a solution. This is what we call for in all of the different arenas, whether it be in Syria, in Bahrain, in Yemen, in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, in Iraq, with the latest developments happening in Iraq, also in Lebanon, so that nobody would head to a collision. In the end, everybody has something to say, everyone has logic, everybody is rational, everybody has rights, we must listen to one another, and we must address our matters and our issues in this way, even if it takes time. It's better than going and colliding with one another, whereby we will destroy our countries and our societies and our peoples, and the West and Israel sit down and watch us and make fun of us. And hence, then, they abandon those, even those whom they pushed in order to be involved in a certain battle. And we have a lot of examples on this throughout history. The most important issue is, I remember Imam Musa Sadr, may God bring him back to us. You know, in the 1970s, a big ceremony was held in Baalbek, and also a ceremony was held in Tyre, and he spoke about the rights of those who were forbidden, or the poor people. However, when the civil war began in Lebanon, he stopped. He said that the state is being absent, the country is being destroyed. We want a country to stay, and we want a state to remain in order to demand the rights. Nobody can come and destroy the state and the country for the sake of reforms or for the sake of rights. the country must remain, the state must remain in order to request these rights and go ahead with the reforms. This only can happen by dialogue, by discussion, by a settlement. And even if there is a confrontation, let it be a peaceful confrontation, and let's abstain from any kind of collisions or fighting. Now, today, the responsibility of the high-ranking senior figures in our Muslim and Arab world, the writers, the intellectuals, the institutions, the media, they have a big responsibility because people listen to them and they follow them and they obey them. And so their responsibility now in this world and in the aftermath is bigger than any time before. Now I'd like to say a few words about the Israeli elections in brief as well. The Israeli elections bring about the following conclusions. Now, if there are some people who are not concerned, who are not following what is going on in the Israeli entity, we believe that this concerns us, whatever be the situation in Lebanon and in the region, because the fundamental problem is over there. It began over there. The creation of this entity, the presence of this entity, and a lot of what is going on and what is going on and what went on before is for the sake of this entity and for its continuation, for its interests. We can say, I don't want to analyze, I just want to conclude that the leading parties now have lost some of their influence, like the Labour Party, the Likud Party. It's clear that they have some problems. There is the absence of a leading strong party. This is what Netanyahu said before. He said Israel needs a strong party to lead Israel. These Israeli elections didn't lead to such a strong party to lead Israel or this entity. The absence of central leaders, fundamental leaders. Remember, previously, actually, this is not me, one person told me that when Sharon was speaking in this fiery way, when he was creating fear in the Arab world and in the region at that time, someone came and told me, don't be afraid, Sharon is the last king of Israel. At that time I said in one of my speeches, the last king of Israel, that's what it seems. Where do we have after Sharon? Who do we have? Yes, they accepted Netanyahu because there's nobody else. This is maybe the best one of those who remain, those figures who remains. However, it's clear the crisis of trust towards Netanyahu, so the absence of important and big figures. Also, the religious right-wing parties and the increase of other parties. And this complicates the administrating process and also complicates the decision-making process. What happened in general reflects a crisis of leadership in the entity, a crisis of parties, and a crisis of trust, a crisis of the entity. However, what we must focus on, we must not be tricked, whether it be before, now, or in the future. We must not be tricked by the issue of right-wing or left or centrist, or centrist of centrist, or right-wing. Regarding Jerusalem al-Quds, regarding Palestine, regarding the rights of the Palestinian people, regarding the Palestinian cause, regarding the Palestinian refugees, regarding the Arab issues and Arab rights from the Golan Heights to Lebanon, to the Sinai Peninsula, to Egypt, with respect to the Israeli greed, with respect to the Israeli threats to the governments and the peoples of the region, the right, the left, the centrist, the left, they are all one, they are all the same. Experience has told us that most of the wars which were waged by Israel were waged during the governments of the Israeli left. And so here, nobody should take the analysis to the left or the right. It's the same whether they are right-wing or left or centrist or a national unity government. From this angle of the confrontation, there's no difference. Yes, when there are different numbers, different groups, political decision-making will be difficult, performance will be difficult. However, with respect to the project, the vision, the greed, the threats, nothing changes. And we must not rely on anything in this perspective. Today, the guarantee of Gaza is the strength of the resistance in Gaza. The guarantee of Palestine and the Palestinian people and the Palestinian rights is the reconciliation and the cohesion of the Palestinian people and their holding on to the choice of resistance. The guarantee of Lebanon, whoever be the ruler in Israel, whether he be Netanyahu or Sharon or Shimon Peres or Barak or Lapid or anyone else, the guarantee for Lebanon is this equation which we always spoke of, the equation of the army, people and resistance. Our strength, our national strength, is what protects Lebanon with its different elements. It's no difference who is over there, centrist, right or left. They look at Lebanon. Do we have an ability? Can we bring about deterrence? This is what protects Lebanon. And then you can look for the oil, for the gas, you can protect your country and your borders, etc. But any other approach is meaningless. And the experience which we witnessed over tens of years tells us this. And also on the level of the region. So I'd like to tell you the most important response to the Israeli elections, whatever be the conclusion and analysis, is to call for more holding on to the resistance. We must all cooperate in order for the Palestinians to be strong in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Palestine and outside Palestine. We must all cooperate so that the resistance will be strong and increase in strength in Lebanon. And we must all cooperate in order to dismantle all of the mines which exist now in our Arab surroundings. This is the response, appropriate response to the Israeli elections. Now in Lebanon, I would like to say a few words. Today in Lebanon, the most important issue which is gaining attention, which is overshadowing the political issue, is the elections, the parliamentary elections and the electoral law. I want to speak about this subject because, as you know, we, at the level of Hezbollah, we have stopped the media interviews, and so we are not involved too much in the debates and the discussions, and we still insist on this because, unfortunately, a lot of the political media focus, there is in a lot of this, there is no objective discussion, no respectful discussion or debate, only curses, insults. So we must here disassociate ourselves from these arguments at this level, unfortunately. The issue of the electoral law at this time was always a sensitive issue for the Lebanese. However, I believe at this time it's even more sensitive. And maybe all of the political factions, all of the Lebanese political factions and all of the Lebanese sects, between brackets, because this is the reality, the issue of religious sects, it exists. They all view the electoral law at this period maybe with more sensitivity than ever before because of the situation we witnessed, the conditions we witnessed in the country, the fears in the country, the sharp divisions in the country, and also what helped this, what contributed, is what is going on in the region. For example, what we spoke of, Christians and Muslims. Today, the Christians, of course, they have bigger fears, not only for Lebanese reasons, because of what's going on in the region. Let's be realistic. Let's not say that some Christians are overreacting. I'll speak about the Muslims as well. But when the Christians, when they see, for example, when they see what happened to the Christians in Iraq, what's happening to the Christians in Syria, what's happening in other places, what's happening in Nigeria, what's happening here and there, it's their right to be afraid, irrespective of who assumes responsibility or who's responsible. I'm not holding anyone responsible. I'm describing the reality. So the developments in the region, they've added to the complications and to the Lebanese debate over the electoral law. Now, the perspective is not only about a normal electoral law or about electing a normal parliament. It's about fate and destiny. Maybe for some, the current argument is building a Lebanon once again, but by an electoral law. So what we're running away from, when I spoke about a national conference for Lebanon, for the Lebanese state, when all people spoke and rose against me, but I'd like to assure you that many of the people in Lebanon today are discussing the electoral law as a means for laying the foundations for Lebanon once again. That's their right, I'm not criticizing. So as a result of the sensitivity and because of the danger of the current period, the regional situation and the international situation, we the Lebanese, we must be patient towards one another and we must discuss more and we must try to reach a result in order to reassure all those who are afraid, although some people might be more afraid than others. So in this perspective, the most important thing is to set the accusations aside, to put them aside. This doesn't bring about, this doesn't help at all. On the contrary, sometimes there are insulting accusations. For example, we want to defend ourselves here. I heard some political figures and some members of parliament, some of them are Christians and some are affiliated with certain political movements, when they speak about the Orthodox proposal and they say that this is the Hezbollah project. Let's forget, they said it's the Bashar al-Assad project, they said it's the project of former parliament speaker Elie Fereslie. Fereslie is part of the Orthodox proposal, but to approach the discussion about such issues which build a state and decide the fate of the country for 4 years or more than 4 years in the future, we cannot approach such issues with such hatred. For example, the Orthodox proposal is the Hezbollah project, and Hezbollah imposed this on its Christian allies, on General Aoun and Minister Frangieh and the Tashnak party. And the Christian allies of Hezbollah, they had to do this. It was imposed on them by Hezbollah, and in one way or another, they were convinced by it, or the Christians began to compete with one another. So the Kirki and the Falange and the Lebanese forces, they went ahead. This is an insult to all of the Christians in Lebanon and an insult to Kirki and the Christian church in Lebanon, to the Christian leaders, to the Christian factions, whether we agree with them or we disagree with them. However, this was not stated in an article or in an interview. It was worked on and it's still being worked on now. Statements and articles. This is not a responsible way in approaching the issue. These are lies and it's not true and it's an exaggeration. If you think that Hezbollah is able to impose on its Christian allies and make the Christian allies to go ahead with any project they want, even the March 14 Christians, then give us the country and step aside. This is really an overreaction and an exaggeration. However, what is more important is the insults of against Christians by using such language, because the issue is not as such. On the contrary, during the discussions, when we were proposed, I've forgotten what the answer which they gave us. They refused or they expressed their reservations. However, then our allies came, they spoke to us, they explained their reservations, their fears, and we accepted. This is the appropriate approach. This is what happened. This is really what occurred, and I'll refer to it later. So this way to approach such a sensitive issue is not true, it's not correct, it's not an appropriate way to approach such a matter. Now let's speak about the intentions. Let's put the intentions aside. Now, I believe that there are normal intentions. For example, everybody looks for an electoral law which preserves its size. Or some people are looking for an electoral law which gives them their appropriate size if they don't have this size or this representation in parliament. That's their right. If they believe that they are putting together an electoral law in order to preserve their size or to achieve their appropriate representation, and even more, even further, is some people are discussing an electoral law to get more than their own representation or their size in parliament. It's their right. This is called politics, a political process. However, I cannot discuss electoral law only according to intentions. But when you drag us somewhere else in the intentions, when you say that Hezbollah and the Amal movement, they approved the orthodox proposal, or General Aoun and Minister Farangiyi are going ahead with this proposal because they plan to delay the elections or to eliminate the elections. This is silly. We have a lot of options. We have a lot of projects. Now, we must not speak about intentions, we must not accuse. Let's approach it in an educational way, in an objective way. From our perspective as Hezbollah, the main principle, the most important principle in any elections is the proportionality. Proportionality. Now, irrespective of our size and our representation, maybe some people could say that proportionality gives you a majority as a political alliance. Maybe tomorrow it might not give us. Maybe proportionality might not give us a majority as a political alliance, because you know, in this country, alliances replace one another, people become upset with one another, the mood changes, there are the regional effects, and we could be transformed into a minority. It's not about what this electoral law would give us, the representation would give us. If you want to speak about a just approach for all the political movements, whether they are political affiliations and religious sects or not, the only option to achieve representation in the parliament is an electoral law based upon proportionality. This is the best way, irrespective of what it achieves for us. The remainder is details for us. We agree in Lebanon, as Lebanon being one electoral district based upon proportionality. We're not against this. If you want it, go. If you want it, okay, go ahead. We agree for Lebanon being divided into the different provinces. We agree for expanded electoral districts. We agree to the government proposal which was made to the parliament, for example, 13 different electoral districts, and we also agree to the orthodox proposal. These are details. However, from our perspective, in all of these proposals, the main matter is adopting all of these in the proportionality system. Why do we adopt the proportional system? Because we believe this gives a chance for all the different groups, for all the different political factions. If they have any level of popular support, this gives them a chance to gain representation in parliament. In discussing proportionality and the proportional system, until now, my information might not be complete, but according to my knowledge, maybe the most important problem, which might be the only problem, but to be safe, let's say the most important problem which is being mentioned by the other side is the weapons. They say that there could not be proportionality with the weapons, weapons meaning the weapons of Hezbollah. This is not true. Can we speak to one another in this issue? First of all, this resistance exists ever before 1992, we saw elections, we participated in 1996, 2000, 2005, 2009. When were the weapons used in any electoral district in order to impose electoral choices? Please give me an example. This is reality. If you want to speak about intentions, I would respond by speaking about reality, the facts. From 1992 until today, give me one electoral district whereby weapons were used to impose electoral choices. This is number one. Number two, weapons, the weapons which they are complaining about, they say that these weapons exert pressure during the elections. This is no longer the weapons of the resistance. Everybody has weapons. Now, I'll make you laugh. In one village, in order to impose a certain electoral choice by weapons, do you need Zilzal? Do you need a Zilzal rocket? Or do you need a Fajr 5 rocket? Or do you need an Ayyub drone? No, you don't.
Hezbollah Secretary General talking from Beirut, speaking on the birth anniversary of the Prophet Muhammad. I got a couple minutes to wrap up what he spoke up in length, but mainly, aside from the fact that he said the Prophet Muhammad brings about Muslim unity, he said countries in the Arab and Islamic world, well, they're experiencing divisions, and some are citing that to be sectarian, some are citing for that to be other problems, such as Shia and Sunni conflict, but that's not always the case. It's not always sectarian. It's said in many cases, if not most cases, it is mainly for political reasons, and also it could be as resources to be an incentive for some of these conflicts. Patience and dialogue, he said, should reach settlements, whether it's in Syria, Bahrain, Iraq, Lebanon, and some other countries. On the Israeli elections, he said, the leading parties have lost some of their influence in terms of the parties that he was speaking about. He was talking about Likud and Labor parties. And regarding Palestine, refugees, Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and all the other different Palestinian issues, he said, we must all cooperate with the resistance to be strong, not only in Lebanon, but in the occupied territories. Of course, we'll give you a wrap-up of that in our news coming up in just a few minutes' time. Do stay with us. Hello, and welcome back to World News here on Press TV. The Secretary General of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, says resistance is the only option to confront Israeli threats. Said Hassan Nasrallah called on people in Lebanon and Palestine to further enhance resistance to guarantee their rights against Israeli threats. He said no changes have actually been made in Israel, even now that the recent elections have brought less powerful figures than before. Nasrallah says the nature of the Israeli regime is to impose threats, so people in Lebanon and in Palestine must strengthen resistance and national unity to confront those threats. Let's bring in Ali Risk, who's a correspondent over in Beirut, who joins us to tell us about what he thinks was important highlights. But Ali, I'm looking at a couple of things. First of all, the elections in Israel, also regarding the Muslim unity and about the sectarian nature of some of these conflicts, not to be the case, as he said. Any other highlights that, of course, you feel were important?
Well, I think that first and foremost, especially considering the occasion, the anniversary of the birth of the Prophet, that Islamic unity was the main focus. And if you look at the speech and even previous speeches which have been made recently by Sayyid Hassan, you can sense that even he believes that the most imminent danger in the Muslim world is actually the issue of sectarianism, even more than the danger which is coming from Israel. In recent speeches, a lot of his words, a lot of his time has been devoted to that particular subject. In this speech today, he did speak about how certain conflicts might be taken, or the religious sectarian element could be taken advantage of in order to achieve political aims. And he gave the historic list of previous wars which were waged for political reasons, but where the religious element might have been taken advantage of. And I think that this goes for our day of time, especially now with the Syrian issue or the Syrian conflict increasingly being given a sectarian label. And I think another country which must be mentioned here where the sectarian card is also played a lot is Iraq and the latest developments which are taking place in Iraq. So I think that what he might have been hinting to is that those who have a big role to play, whether it be in Syria or in Iraq, and I think that the two countries which immediately come to mind, although he didn't mention them, the two countries which immediately come to mind here are Turkey and also Saudi Arabia, their roles in what is going on in Syria and also what's going on in Iraq. So first and foremost, I think this shows the increased concern about the sectarian nature and taking advantage of the sectarian card. We all hear a lot today about Sunnis and Shias and about the fact or about how some are trying to portray what is going on in Syria as something between Sunnis and Shia or Sunnis and Alawites. What is going on in Iraq now is being described as an uprising against Nur al-Maliki, against Shiism, against Iran, etc., etc. So I think basically that was the most important part of his speech. The second most important was Israel. Previously, in a previous speech, Sayyid Hassan had stated that one of Israel's weak points today is the lack of wise politicians, the lack of a strong leadership. And I think he repeated that today. He said that these elections indeed do show that Israel no longer has a wise political leadership. So I think that what he tried to imply as well is that in addition to the success achieved by resistance movements, which has brought about Israel weakness, another weakness which could be added to Israel in addition to the demographics, the in eroding international support, the advance made by resistance and the weapons technology in non-conventional warfare. Another weakness which we could add to Israel's weaknesses is the lack of wise politicians, big political or senior political figures. So I think all in all, that were the main, most important elements. However, it does appear clear that in this time, with the events in Syria, the sectarian card, the issue of Muslims, that remains the first and foremost concern.
Very well. Good to see you. Thank you so much. Ali Rister, correspondent, talking to us from Beirut.